From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Rasha McChesney with this look at regional and statewide news. The small southeast Alaska village of Cake spent most of Tuesday morning on lockdown following reports of an armed man firing shots around the Kuprianov Island community. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, Alaska state troopers flew in several hours later and made an arrest at the airport.
Cake has no police department to respond to crimes in progress. City officials referred questions to Joel Jackson, tribal president for the organized village of Cake. He says he had a very tense morning.
Well, it started with a break-in at our grade school, and then there was some gunfire up in our housing project. And sorry, my voice is so hoarse, but I've been up all night. So,
Alaska State Troopers say they received a report of a broken window at Cake School shortly before 4 a.m. About 45 minutes later, they had a call that a man had entered someone's home without permission. The intruder had left, but shortly afterward, the caller heard four gunshots. As the town began to wake up, reports began to fly around the community that it wasn't safe to go outdoors. Katie Anderson is a teacher's aide at Cake School. She says she arrived at work to find broken glass, went home, and saw reports of an active shooter online.
The store, the grocery store, is shut down. The school is shut down. And the clinic, the Cake clinic, is shut down. And everybody's been told to stay home and lock their doors.
According to a timeline provided by troopers, another call came in shortly after 9 a.m., providing additional details of an armed man in the town. Troopers departed for Cake afterward. By 11 a.m., it was all over. Jackson says the suspect was arrested at Cake's airport without incident.
Troopers landed. He was taken into custody up there, so he's out of here.
Authorities ID'd the alleged shooter as Keith Nelson, a 48-year-old resident of Cake. He faces a number of criminal charges, and troopers say they're still investigating the morning's events. But Department of Public Safety spokesman Austin McDaniel says initial reports are that no one was harmed.
At this time, we are not aware of any injuries. And based on initial information, we do not believe the individual was threatening any individual person.
Cake has no armed law enforcement presence in a community of 500 people. That's a problem, the tribe's president says, because there are long gaps without anyone to respond to public safety emergencies.
It'd be nice if we had law enforcement in our small village. We got two VPSOs supposed to arrive today for 2 weeks, and then they're gone for 2 weeks. So we have nothing. I'm basically answer calls because people don't know who to call. So
Jackson adds there hasn't been any reported gun violence in quite some time. And he says unarmed village public safety officers aren't equipped to respond to active shooters. This incident has already rekindled discussions about a lack of law enforcement in remote communities like Cake. Anderson, who has lived there for 5 years, says there are incidents that don't get the attention they should because there's no police.
This is concerning enough, I think, that other communities should know about it, because we do need law and order out here in the town.
Authorities have released little information about the suspect, a possible motive, or the type of weapon involved. He's currently at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau, awaiting his first day in court. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska remains at the top of the list for the highest rate of COVID-19 infections in the country, and with a higher proportion of unvaccinated residents occupying hospital beds, Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, is pointing to misinformation and distrust as major factors. Zink recently penned an editorial in the Washington Post reflecting on the pandemic. In part of the piece, Zink writes about treating an unvaccinated patient struggling with COVID who had spent hundreds of dollars on unproven online remedies that didn't help. As Zink told Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove, the pandemic has highlighted many problems with our healthcare system and in society.
And I also am continually frustrated by the way that our medical system and medical education don't train providers to work in rural communities. I would love to see our system as a whole help to address some of those inequities that we see within the healthcare system. I've learned so much from so many people throughout this pandemic, but I think one of the things that I took away from my conversations with many Alaska Native people have been the history of the 1918 pandemic and how remembering that history really changed the way in which they responded to the pandemic, and their amazing partnership with vaccination and testing and remembering that history moving forward. And I hope that we as a state can remember many of the things that have happened and be able to rebuild on that moving forward so that we aren't impacted the same way when another infectious disease comes through.
That op-ed mentions the misinformation that's out there that is in some cases leading to people being hospitalized or worse. Have you been increasingly frustrated about that, I guess? I mean, that even if we do our best to try to educate people, if they don't buy into it or listen to the experts, that we're sort of still stuck in the same place with that?
I think about misinformation and disinformation as well as communication across the board. And we learn from stories. We don't learn from data points. And I think we need to be better storytellers about what we see. I think as scientists, as healthcare professionals, and as public health professionals, we need to do a better job about communicating the science in a way that people can understand, that they can feel comfortable asking questions. But it's also, there are some really aggressive players in the misinformation and disinformation space that are making a lot of money. And I think that's one of the hardest things for me when I'm in the emergency department. You know, I've never met someone who isn't vaccinated because they want to be ill or because they don't care about their friends or their family or their community or their business. They're trying to make the best decisions they can with the information that's presented to them. And oftentimes what they're seeing, either from their friends, from their family, from social media, from other sources, is an underestimation of the risk of COVID and an overestimation of the risk of vaccine. And in that process, they make a decision not to get vaccinated. They get sick and they show up in the hospital oftentimes when it is too late to do a lot.
It seems pretty clear that the end of the political spectrum that is the most susceptible to this misinformation is pretty closely aligned with the folks that support the governor as a Republican governor. Do you think that he has done enough to speak directly to those people about the truth of vaccines and strongly enough about masking and things like that?
I think that you can see on all sides of the political spectrum a whole series of bits of misinformation or disinformation and aggression. We do see a political difference in those who have chosen to get vaccinated and those who have not chosen to get vaccinated. We're all individual people doing the best that we can in our individual scenarios. I come at this as the chief medical officer, and that is the lens in which I approach it. The governor is the governor for the whole state and has to think about and deal with a lot of other things. While I can point fingers and say this should have been different or that should have been different, I'm sure there's many, many things I could do differently as well. At the end of the day, again, I think the more that we divide each other rather than focusing on the virus, the worse off we are. And I'm grateful that our team is able to speak to the data and science as it comes out and be able to be honest to that space.
Can I ask, did the governor's office or the governor himself need to approve the op-ed that was in the Washington Post?
I spoke to the governor about it. He knew I was publishing it. It wasn't the op-ed he would have written, but he said, you know, there's freedom of speech and I can write what I wanted to write. So he knew that I was writing it in that space. So, but again, our voices are different and our focuses are different in that space. And I want to be truthful to everyone I work with, the Alaska public, the governor, the commissioner, my team. And so I did make sure that the governor's office, as well as the commissioner and our public health information team knew about it before it went out.
Dr. Zink, one thing I wanted to ask you is just, and maybe this is kind of a personal question, but as a frontline healthcare worker and as the chief medical officer for the state, you've been as involved in the response to this virus as anyone. And I wondered, do you feel like it's changed you at all? I mean, as a person to have been in those roles?
100%, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's been the most intense learning curve of my life, for sure. It's been intense. I think it has made me realize the complexity of state and federal government, the challenges in communication. It's been heartbreaking to see just so many people sick when oftentimes I think that their illness is preventable. We see it with other diseases, but not to the same degree, not to the same impact, and not so many healthy people coming in so sick and dying. I think the amount of illness and death and dying in the department is heartbreaking. It's really hard to see.
That was Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, talking to Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove. Every year, the Coast Guard deploys ships, helicopters, and maritime safety teams around the state in advance of the busy Alaska summer. The operation, known as Arctic Shield, ended on Sunday with its temporary base in Kotzebue shutting down for the winter. Since July 1st, Kotzebue has served as a base for two MH-60 Jayhawk helicopters and their crews. They report responding to 15 search and rescue cases and are credited with saving 18 lives, according to a statement from the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard also deployed a maritime safety and security team from San Francisco to enforce vessel safety standards and assist in search and rescue. Coast Guard personnel in District 17 reported performing 128 facility inspections and 470 commercial fishing vessel safety exams. Additionally, four cutters and the icebreaker Healy patrolled around the Aleutian Chain and in southeast Alaska waters. Operation Arctic Shield began in 2009. This year's deployments also featured training and maneuvers with the Japanese Navy and Canadian and Russian Coast Guards. A University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist contributed to a study that looked at the demise of a Middle Eastern city 6,000 years ago. KUAC's Mary Ald reports.
Researchers know that in the Middle Bronze Age, Tal el-Hammam was a thriving city of 8,000 residents. Then, suddenly, the city was destroyed and abandoned. Some have theorized that Tal el-Hammam is the city referred to in the Bible as Sodom. Researchers have spent years trying to uncover what demolished the city. In a recent study published in Scientific Reports, scientists presented their conclusion that an airburst from a comet or meteor destroyed the city when it hit with a force thousands of times more powerful than the Hiroshima atomic bomb. Gunther Kletechka is an associate research professor at the UAF Geophysical Institute. He was part of a team that analyzed the remains of the city to determine how it was destroyed. Kletechka said researchers were initially stumped about what happened to the city.
They could not find any arrowheads, any spearheads, so there was no sign of a war. Then there would be an earthquake, but usually after several years, people just go back and settle it.
Researchers found pottery and bricks that had melted, evidence that the area had been exposed to extremely high temperatures. They thought that could mean a lightning strike destroyed the city. That's where Kletechka came in. He analyzed the magnetism of shards of material from the site. His inspection ruled out a lightning strike, but he found a unique structure in quartz from the site that gave a clue as to what could have happened.
There is not any other way to make it. There is either nuclear, like a nuclear bomb, or there is a hit of the extraterrestrial body. And we found it. So that was a ringer.
That's how researchers knew a comet or meteor had destroyed the city. But the site didn't show the telltale crater that usually accompanies the touchdown of an extraterrestrial object. Kletechka said that's because the object likely exploded before it hit the Earth, destroying the city with the resulting airburst rather than the impact of the object.
They don't leave a crater.
So should we worry that an extraterrestrial object is going to explode above Fairbanks and destroy the city? It's possible, but not likely, Kletechka says. But he does think an event like the one that destroyed Tal el-Hammam could have happened in Alaska at some point. He's testing that hypothesis by analyzing sediment in lakes across the region, seeking evidence that an airburst from a comet or meteor hit in this part of the world.
That shows something weird happened, and so I'm here to find out.
For KUAC, I'm Mary Ald.
Sitka's Fish and Game Advisory Committee wants to revive a local bear working group to look for solutions to the high number of kills in the community this season. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The tally of brown bears killed in Sitka now stands at 13, 12 bears killed by wildlife authorities, and one killed by a car and whose cub was later euthanized by Fish and Game. Area Management Biologist Steve Bethune told the committee at its October 27th meeting that he doesn't know what kind of toll this is taking on the bear population of Baranof Island, because that number has never been determined. He asked the committee to write a letter to the State Board of Game to deploy a research team for a thorough 2 to 3 year study.
With what everything is going on around here, I would be really interested in a Baranof estimate. We've had population estimates on North Admiralty and Northeast Chichagof. We've never had one anywhere on Baranof Island. So I know a lot of people anecdotally think that the population is increasing. I can't say with any data to support that one way or the other.
Although he doesn't know how many bears are on Baranof Island, Bethune is convinced that easy access to garbage is what brings them into town. 7 years ago, a Sitka Bear Task Force was formed to look into the problem and to explore possible solutions like upgraded garbage cans. Committee member Andrew Tomes served on the original task force, which, rather than recommend bear-proofing measures on cans, advised the assembly to enact ordinances governing how and when Sitkins can dispose of garbage.
Brown bears can get into whatever. They're real strong, and so all of those things just don't work, and that's where it came down to. You know, you got to keep your garbage inside, reduce the amount of garbage you have, or take it down to Crescent Harbor or the transfer station and drop it off. That was pretty much what we came to.
The flaw in that plan was compliance. Bethune said that just one or two households improperly handling trash could bring bears into a neighborhood. Committee member Tad Fujioka suggested turning that behavior to advantage.
What if you looked at it from the other way and we had some booby-trapped garbage cans out there? Maybe it would only take one or two bad experiences for a bear to associate that big black thing with unfavorable experience.
Bethune said he was interested in hearing creative ideas to address the problem. He's been a vocal advocate for the use of simple electric fences in Sitka, equipment which is relatively inexpensive. But for some committee members, there already was a proven method for managing bears in town. This is Woody Sear.
It sucks and it's horrible, but I think being aggressive with lethal take is not a bad thing at all. And that by taking some quicker, then you save more in the long run. It seems like it's just way too okay for them to be in town.
Member Jeff Feldpausch also was reluctant to move forward with a new task force since it seemed likely to lead to the same result.
I have a feeling this is just going to turn around and be going to be like the initial round of the working group. Basically, it's going to attack the public and require them to come up with either more money to pay fines or more money to build a shed or whatever. And it's just going to turn back on the public. So I'm voting no.
Feldpausch said that his strategy of choice was to thin the bears. Bethune has examined all of the 13 bears killed in Sitka so far this year. None was skinny or hungry. Rather, they appeared to be in robust health with enough fat stores to survive the winter. That hasn't always been the case with Sitka's bears. Their circumstances change year to year, and so do the attitudes of Sitka's human residents.
And this town is different than it was 20 years ago, and I hear all kinds of stories about, you know, we used to have a landfill, so when a bear showed up at the landfill, we'd just kill it and rolled into the burn pit, or back in the mill days, people would just kill a bear when it came into a neighborhood. So it's just a different mentality now than it used to be.
On a split vote, the Sitka Fish and Game Advisory Committee urged the Sitka Assembly to take measures to mitigate the bear problem. The committee will also send a letter to the Board of Game in support of a bear population study on Baranof Island. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A group of seven hunters has been stuck at a fish camp on the Yukon River for 5 days. Emonic Search and Rescue says the group was on its way back from a hunting trip and stopped off at a fish camp. The ice buildup became too thick for them to boat back down, and they are currently stuck about 20 miles east from Emonic. The group has been in communication with local search and rescue groups via an inReach satellite communication device. The boaters have shelter, supplies, and have been able to stay warm. November 1st was the first time that rescuers were able to reach the group's location. Alaska State Troopers were able to drop off food and medications. A spokesperson for the Alaska State Troopers said the troopers have known of the hunters' location for 4 days. He said troopers are waiting for a break in the foggy, turbulent weather so they can charter an aircraft to pick them up. And finally, two separate incidents this fall have some Kenai Peninsula Borough School District teachers worried about book censorship. Teachers at Kalifornsky Beach Elementary School were told to temporarily stop teaching a book after a school administrator found it age inappropriate. And separately, the district withheld books about sexuality from the Seward High School library that it deemed controversial. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has the story.
Teachers Association President Nathan Erfurth says both instances violate the due process for reviewing instructional materials. He says the Teachers Association filed a complaint about the situation at the library and are in conversation with the district about the incident at K Beach.
Ultimately, what we're looking for is accountability and making sure that our school district follows its own policies.
District Superintendent Clayton Holland said the school district is aware of the complaints and is looking into them.
We're not out to limit, you know, anyone's instruction or, in particular, a kid's ability to pick up a book that they choose to pick up and read.
Last month, two fourth and fifth grade teachers at K Beach Elementary came under fire for reading their students' Flight of the Puffin, a novel by Anne Braden about inclusivity that features non-gender conforming characters. Erfurth says the teachers read the book in class to create an inclusive environment for non-gender conforming students in the class, and that they skipped portions of the book they deemed irrelevant or age inappropriate. In their weekly updates to parents, the teachers posted notes about the sections they were reading out loud to the class. After a parent complained to the district office, the principal of the school sent an email to parents saying she regretted that the book was read aloud in class, since she reviewed it and decided it was not age or grade appropriate. She said, quote, "While the overall theme of the book is acceptance, there are topics that are best left to families to discuss. Our school's role is to focus on academics, and this book is not approved KPBSD curricular material for instruction," end quote. District policy says books and other instructional material cannot be taken out of circulation until a complaint process is finished. According to the district's policy review manual, individual students can be excused from reading the challenged material. Quote, "Use of materials by a class, school, or the district, however, shall not be restricted until the board has made a final decision." After the district superintendent receives a complaint, a committee of administrators, teachers, and community members convenes to review it. The decision made by that committee then heads to the school board for review and approval. The book that the teachers were reading with their classes isn't officially written into the English curriculum. Therefore, Holland says, it's not subject to the same review process.
We're not into censorship of any kind and believe in, you know, books that promote kindness and tolerance and all that. You know, I think when it comes to the one you're talking about, it really involves, you know, making sure we know it's age appropriate. And if there's any question about it, you know, making sure parents have an awareness too and following that.
And he says the school is taking an immediate pause on the book, not banning it altogether, while it reviews whether it is age appropriate. But Erfurth says discretion on which books to read in a class is usually left to teachers. He thinks the book should have gone through the traditional review process. Separately, the district recalled books sent to the Seward High School library during a routine restocking this fall, including titles with LGBTQ themes. In an email sent in late August, Assistant Superintendent Carrie Denderen told the school secretary she filed a request to recall several titles from the school's library. The subject line of the email reads, "Controversial books sent to Seward High School that need to be verified as appropriate for teens." Titles on the list include The Gay Liberation Movement, Everything You Need to Know About Bisexuality, and I Am a Feminist, as well as We Are Not Yet Equal, Understanding Our Racial Divide, and Being Jazz, My Life as a Transgender Teen. In the email, Denderen asked the school secretary to retrieve books on the list if they had already been checked out by students. The curriculum review policy also covers non-required materials like library books. Decisions on non-required materials go through the Instructional Materials Review Committee as well, and then the superintendent. Holland says those books were returned to the library earlier this month.
And so, you know, I'm looking into why the delay on books being returned.
Also earlier this month, Soldotna High School librarian Tamara Weir sent an email to the school board about the books. She said in the email, students are entitled to equal access of materials and resources that reflect their own lives under federal and board policies and goals. Erfurth says he's particularly concerned that the books that were called back centered around LGBTQ characters and themes, since there have been several reported instances of bullying of transgender and queer students in Kenai Peninsula schools.
The problem right now, the thing that makes me concerned, is that there is one demographic here that is starting to see some strange decisions that the district is making. And we want to make sure that we don't let that continue.
The Teachers Association filed a personnel complaint against Denderant following the incident. Those complaints are handled by the supervisor of the person listed in the complaint. Holland says he's unable to talk about ongoing personnel complaints. Erfurth says even amid those two instances, the district has also done a lot of good in creating an inclusive space for students.
And the fact that what's happened over the last several weeks is such a shock to a lot of people, that's actually a good sign, because that means that this sort of thing is not the norm in our school district. It's an aberration, which makes it all the more important that we address it.
He says recently the district created a resolution that allows for symbols of inclusion inside classrooms, like pride flags, in response to an uptick in student vandalism. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
This is KTOO News.